tonight. Are crystals the future? Your EV and an arc, Big Bertha gets stuck, and Steve Kovac drops by to tell us the ins and outs of reviewing gadgets. Padres Corner is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Padres Corner is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Padres Corner, episode 10, recorded Tuesday, October 14th, 2014. Gadgets with Steve Kovac. Hello and welcome to Padres Corner. It's the Twitch show where we put you into the mind of a Jesuit priest and see if you come out sane on the other side. I'm Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit Padre SJ in the Twit TV chat room. A while back, Lisa and Leo came to me and they said, you know what, we want a little something, a hangout, a place where our audience can come to talk about the news that really matters to them, that geeks and gals want to hear, the stuff that falls through the regular cracks, and this be that very show. And as always, we're going to start off with some freaking science. Now, when you think about oxygen, of course, you're thinking about something that we all need, something that we all need to live. I mean, it's a necessary component of life. But in the future, your O2 may come from crystals. That's right. We've got a story here from Popular Science. It's all about dissect nitrogen dipyridylmethyl aminomethyl quad tert butyl phenolato diamino quad benzene dicarboxylato nitrogen trioxide dihydrogen dioxide. That is my absolutely horrible mispronunciation of the chemical formulation for this substance that researchers over at the University of South Denmark were able to find. It's an interesting substance in that it's a cobalt salt. It's comprised of those chemical elements that I just mentioned. But the important part is that it sucks up oxygen like a sponge. That newly discovered salt can hold O2 at a concentration that is 160 times higher than the air at sea level. Now, enough of the substance would be able to pull 99% of the oxygen out of a room without any external energy use. It's just that's the nature of that crystal. In fact, it has such an affinity for O2 that placing the crystal in water would actually pull O2 out of solution. Of course, such a substance wouldn't really be useful if all it did was soak up O2. I mean, that's kind of cool. It'd be an interesting science project, but you need a way to release it. Thankfully, there is. If you heat the crystals, or if you place the crystals in an environment where there is no oxygen, it actually releases O2 back into the environment, which means we now have a convenient way to store a lot of O2 in a very small space without any serious power use, and we have an easy way to release it back into the environment. Now, imagine where you could use this. Of course, scuba divers. If you were underwater, a couple of crystals, a little teaspoon of these crystals would actually be able to pull the O2 that you need to breathe out of the water that surrounds you. And as long as you had a power source that could heat the crystals just a tiny fraction, it means that you would no longer need scuba gear and you wouldn't need a rebreather. You would literally be breathing the O2 from the water around you. It would also be useful for those patients who need to lug around canisters of compressed air because, well, that's kind of heavy. Well, in this case, you don't have to compress the O2. The O2 just has an affinity for those crystals. Have a few teaspoons of the crystals with the O2 saturation and then heat them up to give those patients that air that they need. It would also be great, and this is what's got me really excited, for fuel cells. To have a fuel cell, you need a hydrogen source and you need an O2 source. We already have a way to get hydrogen out of a substance. There are several substances that have an affinity for hydrogen that if you heat up or expose to water, they'll release it. But O2 has been a bit trickier. In the environment here on Earth, we're able to pull it out of the air. But if you're in an environment that has no O2, you need to bring your own source. With this new crystal, we could have crystals of H2, crystals of O2, and have power. So maybe in the future, your life will be powered by crystals. Now let's move from some freaking science to some freaking engineering. Now let me set you up with a scenario here. Let's say that you're driving your EV, your electronic vehicle, and you're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, this is something that people fear. If you drive an electric vehicle, you need a place to plug it in. That's why so many of us have tethered ourselves to hybrids, either serial or parallel. We like to have that source of energy that doesn't need to come from the battery because once your battery is dead, your EV goes from a joy machine two or three tons of dead weight. Well, now let's say that you're in this car and you're driving out on your, say you've got 75 mile range and you need to get 100 miles from your origin. Well, once you pass that point of no return, that point at which you can't go back to your origin and you don't have enough juice in the tank to make it to your destination, you should be sweating, but you're feeling just fine. And the reason why you're feeling fine is because all along the roadway are dotted solar charging stations. This sounds like a dream, but this is something that's actually being worked on right now. A man by the name of Desmond Wheatley is the CEO of Envision Solar, and he wants to sell this to the public. Quite simply, this is a solar charging station. They call it the EV ARC, or Electronic Vehicle Autonomous Renewable Charger. They've created an off-the-grid solar charging unit for EVs that can be dropped anywhere. Now, each of these is contained in a kit, and every kit has a 22.5 kilowatt-hour lithium-ion battery pack, enough solar cells to completely charge that pack with just a day of sun, a solar tracking system that adjusts the solar cells to optimize charging, and a 5.5-ton steel plate and structure. Now, each kit fits into a standard 16x9 parking space, so they can be installed en masse in cities just as easily as they can be in rural areas. That 5.5-ton charging plate and structure is so that you can put it on an unimproved space. You don't have to pave it. You don't have to give it a foundation. You don't have to level it. As long as it's stable ground, you drop this thing and boom, you're instantly charging your EV. Now, it can also be, and this is what I really like, dropped off by a truck and set up in 5 minutes. So you can have a temporary roadway, a way to top off vehicles as you go. Of course, 22.5 kilowatt hours is not enough to give any vehicle a full charge. Even a Nissan Leaf, which has a reduced 45-mile range, wouldn't be filled up by 22.5 kilowatt hours. But that's not what he's designing these stations for. What he's designing them for is to top off vehicles that need just a little bit more range, just a little bit more juice to make it to a place that's on the grid. I know what you're saying, because I'm in tune with you. And I know chat room is saying, this is stupid. Why would I want to do this? I could put enough fuel in my car to make it to that 100-mile destination easily. Why would I chance it with an EV? Well, quite simply, the reason is that the purpose of EVs is not just to give us another way to drive. It's to change the way that we drive. What Desmond is trying to pitch is moving from the gorging mentality to this idea of grazing. Now, what does that mean? We've been conditioned into thinking that the norm is pulling into a fuel station once every few days to load up on enough fuel to make it the next few days of travel. Now, we use that 5 to 10 minute fill up as gorging to get our energy needs. But why does it have to be that way? If these energy stations, these charging stations, these top off stations were ubiquitous enough, if they could give you a top off in 5 to 10 minutes, enough to make it another 20 miles so you can make it to your destination, and if they were found everywhere that we may want to go, or were able to be deployed quickly enough so that they could accommodate the moving traffic patterns of people, then we move from this idea of gorging, getting all of our energy in one place, to getting our energy as we go. Now, that does a few things. First of all, if we're using these solar stations, it gives us a nice way to get power off the grid, but it also changes the way that we drive. It makes it so that we have to plan our trips, and that actually makes for much more efficient travel, much more efficient use of the energy on hand. I've seen this before. Even with the first generation Prius, it wasn't necessarily the technology that improved your fuel efficiency. It was the fact that they had that little meter in the center console that showed you how much your MPG was, that made you change when you applied the brake, how much acceleration you gave it. If you could do the same thing, but not for speed, but for efficiency of refueling, well, then maybe the next time you charge up, it'll be in the middle of nowhere. Now, when we come back, I don't have a rant. I have something that has tickled me pink, a little interesting project that's been running over in Seattle that, even though it's met with disaster, I think it might change your mind about what it means to be stuck in the mud. But before that, did someone say hoot?
Mr. Al, you okay? It's okay. 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 Oh, it's okay. Please don't give me that look. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, please don't fly. Oh, my. Hey, good boy. Good, don't give me that look. Oh, God, he's gonna fly. Oh, God, he's gonna fly. You're doing good. Doing good. No, don't fly. Don't fly. Oh, shit. Yes! Fuck yeah!
As Chatroom has said, that owl is looking into your soul. Let's talk about being stuck. Everyone hates being stuck. If you've ever lived in an area that has a lot of mud or a lot of obstacles that might stick your mode of transportation, you understand the frustration that comes with being in a situation that you have to call somebody for. Now, if your car gets stuck, you call a tow truck. If your truck gets stuck, you call a hauling rig. If your rig gets stuck, you call for a tractor. But what happens with when your vehicle that gets stuck weighs a few million pounds and costs a few million dollars? That's exactly what happened in Seattle to Big Bertha. Now, Big Bertha is a tunneling machine. It happens to be the biggest tunneling machine ever created. This is an $80 million moving, chewing building that is the largest tunnel boring machine, TBM, ever constructed. Now, last year, Bertha started its path of a 2-mile path under Seattle that would replace a 61-year-old viaduct that was threatening to collapse. It's part of a $1.44 billion contract to complete a 4-lane tunnel by 2015, and Bertha was designed to be tough. It was designed to chew through 8-foot boulders with dozens of steel plowing discs at the front of its cutting head. It generates enough power to light a city of 30,000 people. It contains more steel than the Eiffel Tower and weighs as much. It took millions of dollars and thousands of man hours to build and assemble the machine. But once done, it was supposed to chew through the 1.7 miles of earth in just over a year. And with more than 44,000 pounds of thrust, nothing supposedly could stand in her way. Now, Bertha started to dig as scheduled on July 2013 with much fanfare. There was a parade. The governor and the former governor showed up to christen the machine. Plush toys of Bertha flew off the shelves. Bertha even had her own Twitter account that announced when she was being assembled and when she was being put into place. It was a grand occasion, and Bertha has become somewhat of a minor celebrity in the city of Seattle. She was the symbol of a city that's about to be reborn. I mean, Seattle isn't deserted. It's by no way a city that needs to be reborn. But this idea of recreating the waterfront, the most visible part of a beautiful city, was something that really brought people in. It made people think of the possibilities. And Bertha was a big part of that. Bertha was the chance for the city to shine. And then she got stuck. That's right. Bertha, just 1,000 feet into the dig, stalled. An operator noticed that the torque indicators were going crazy, telling him that Bertha had run into something that it was having difficulty chewing through, which shouldn't have happened. Oh, in December of 2013, they halted tunneling and started digging ahead of the machine to find the obstruction. What they found was this old steel-cased pipe that had been used for some sort of well. Now, they figured that was fine. Once they had cleared it out, Bertha would get back to business, but bad things started to happen. Bertha was heating up. It was slowing down. It wasn't getting the power that it had to. The cutting head started vibrating, and the cutting discs were wearing out prematurely. And finally, Bertha stopped altogether. Now, she can continue to dig, but she can only go forward. And at the pace that she's moving, the finish time of the project moves from 2016 to the year 2200. Obviously, that's no good. And as far as they can tell, the problem has been what Bertha has been eating. On December 3rd, Bertha tried to eat that 8-inch steel well casing, and it did something to the lining, the casing of the head. And that casing, of course, weighing a couple 100,000 pounds, isn't easy to replace. Unfortunately, tunnel boring machines love hard rock. That's their jam. That's what they want to do. If it's a hard rock casing, they can chew through it. But what Bertha was facing was soft rock and sand filled with boulders and, unfortunately, that steel pipe. Now, she's been trying to grind those 8-foot boulders that are suspended in sand, and what happens is that the boulders just end up tumbling around the front of the head, destroying the steel discs, causing a lot of damage, and now Bertha is just damaged, inefficient, and cut off from home. Unfortunately, you can't just back up a machine that big. It's not designed to back up. It's designed to go forward. And now the engineers have had to come up with an ingenious plan to save Big Bertha. What they're going to do is they're going to dig a well in front of Bertha, a big old rescue shaft, if you will, that will allow them to drill through. They're going to make 8 huge concrete columns in the path of Bertha and then put a cradle at the bottom of that well. When Bertha drills through those concrete casings, the drill head will rest on that cradle. They'll then disassemble the front of Bertha, and they'll bring her up to the surface. Once they bring her up to the surface, they're going to upgrade her. She'll get new seals and bearings. She'll get new injection ports so that lubricant can be injected at several points. She'll get 260 new steel ribs, steel reinforcing plates, and a wider cutting mouth to chew through that silty ground. Now, that means they will have a meaner, leaner Bertha back together quickly enough to be done with the project just 11 months after originally scheduled, which is great news considering the fact that they were looking at a delay of a century and a half. Now, here's the thing. The reason why I love this story so much is that it would be easy to look at the story and think of it as hubris. This is a bunch of engineers who chewed off more than they could swallow. It's a bunch of guys who thought it would be so easy to dig through this waterfront, and they ended up getting their multi-million dollar toy stuck. But I don't see that. What I see is what engineers have to do. If you're an engineer, in fact, if you're a geek, if you're a guy who just tinkers around, you understand that nothing, no plan, ever survives first implementation. The minute you put it into reality, the minute that you test out your design, the minute you turn on your program or your tinker toy, you're going to find out that things happen that you did not anticipate. And the meat of an engineer, the test of his strength, the test of his intelligence, is not whether or not reality fits what he thought was going to happen. It's what he does after it doesn't. And I think that's what Bertha does. Bertha is a big project, a big innovation, a big idea that these engineers are putting into solid rock. Now, let's take a little break here, because this is when I absolutely love the show. It's when we get to bring a guest, and we get to talk to him a little bit about what makes him tick. Ladies and gentlemen, a man who I have watched on the Twit TV network for quite a while. He's been on TN2. He's going to be coming up on Twit in a bit, and now he's on Padres Corner. Let me introduce to you the man, the myth, the business insider legend, Mr. Steve Kovac. Steve, thank you very much for coming on Padres Corner.
Hey, thanks for having me. That's quite an intro.
we do that for everyone. It's our thing.
So I'm not that special. That's great.
Okay. No. You are special. You are the special. You are the most interesting, most exciting, most important man in history. I'm sorry. That's a Lego. That's a Lego.
Oh, movie. I know the Lego movie. I got it.
Okay. Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. Man,
that's what I know. Now, sir, this is the part of Padres Corner where we invite guests onto the show. Sometimes it's to talk about a specific topic, but occasionally it's just people who I find interesting, who I've probably found through the Twit TV network, and I want to find out what makes them tick. Let's talk a little bit about you. I know that you work for Business Insider. I know that you're their senior tech editor. You are the man who comes up with the stories that BI has to cover that will affect business, that executives need to know about. But let's go before that. How did you come to tech? Specifically, how did you come to journalism?
It's kind of weird. This job is like a perfect for me in an odd way. Ever since I was a little kid, I've always been into words and language. I taught myself how to read, actually, when I was almost 4 years old, just by kind of having my parents read to me a lot. And then eventually I was able to kind of figure it out. So I was always interested in language and stuff like that. And in school, I always excelled in English and liberal arts. And I was a terrible math student. I can't even, write a check these days. And thank God technology has enabled me so I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. So I've always had that part to me. And at the same time, I've always been a nerd. From the first time I watched Star Wars at age 4 or 5, I was just enthralled with science fiction and fantasy and things like that, more science fiction than fantasy. We got our first computer when I was also 5, I think. So this was 1990-ish, and it was, Windows 3.1. And we had Prodigy, and I was obsessed with Prodigy. I'm sure a lot of people watching now don't even know what Prodigy is.
Do you remember the specs on that first computer?
Oh, God, no.
That must have been like a 286. What was it, 1981?
1990.
Yeah, it's probably a 286, probably with like one gigabyte. No, back then memory was measured in megabytes.
Yeah,
so it was megabytes, like, what, yeah. 4 megabytes, 16 megabytes of memory?
Something like that, yeah, and that was crazy. I remember our second computer after that, it had a 2 gigabyte hard drive, and that seemed like infinite space to us. It had Windows 95 on it. But anyway, so, you know, that first computer, I started playing computer games, and, you know, we had like this wheel. This is also back in the day of actual floppy disks, which I'm sure you remember. And I was just really into it. I was just enthralled. I was always on the computer or always reading a book, or doodling in my journal, writing in my journal. And then eventually as I got older, in middle school and high school, me and my geek friends and I, we'd play video games, build computers, you know, order the parts online or strip out parts from something else. So I just got really into that part too.
Whoa. Let me stop you there. Wait, you built your own computers.
Yeah, me and my friends were better at it than I was. I was just kind of there as the helper monkey. But, you know,
man after my own heart. That's how I grew up in tech. I had to build my systems. And, you know, in the Silicon Valley, because I know you grew up in New York, right?
No, actually, I grew up in Houston.
Oh, you grew up in Houston. Well, in the Silicon Valley, we did dumpster diving. So if you wanted to build your own computer, you'd find, like, the big companies around here. You'd go through their trash, and you'd find enough stuff to bring back to your house so you could build something. But what was the computer scene like in Houston?
It's just me and a couple of my friends. Either we'd use old computers like that our parents wanted to get rid of or something and just kind of hack something together just for fun. Or when I got older in high school, you know, just go in Newegg or whatever and buy all the parts we need to make a gaming machine or something. But then again, I was more into console gaming, actually, I guess, when I was in high school, middle school.
Wait. You know, okay, now I got asked then, what was your console of
in
choice?
High school,
the console.
Oh, okay, geez. Well, I've had a lot. In high school, I was mostly, quite a lot. I was mostly a PS2 and then original Xbox player.
Okay.
And then now I have a Wii U and I love it. And I'm going to buy a PS4, in a couple of weeks, because I really got to get on that Destiny thing. But anyway, so my point is, you know, I just kind of grew up surrounded by this kind of stuff, you know, language and writing and also geekery. I went to journalism school. I went to Syracuse, studied journalism, and I thought it was going to be like your standard city beat reporter or write about politics. I'm really interested in politics too. But then when I graduated, this job posting when Business Insider was a very small site. This was almost 4 years ago to the day, actually, that I interviewed at BI. It was a tiny site. They're looking for someone to write about gadgets. I was like, well, I don't have any experience really writing about gadgets, but I know the world. I used to, you know, as a big Gizmodo reader back in the day and Engadget and BGR and all those, you know, the heyday of tech gadget blogging. So I knew the space well enough. I was like, hey, I can write about this. So I did, and, you know, just kind of took off from there. And I've been doing it for 4 years and moving through the company. And I, you know, it's amazing to see this site grow so much. You know, we were, I think the entire company was even 40 people when I first started. And now we're pushing 200 employees across the company. So it's just an amazing growth in just this time I've been there. So yeah, it's been the perfect fit for me. I just kind of fell into it and I'm loving it.
There is a little something special about starting with a company when it's small. I mean, because you go through that small company feel where everyone's just doing different jobs, and then there's always growing pains. But I think when you go through that process, you get to look back and say, yeah, I remember when this company was just a bunch of guys in a loft trying to figure out exactly how we were going to change the world.
Yeah, we're kind of like that too. When I first started, this is October 2010, I was working in the hallway. Right by the front door, we were in this tiny room. Everyone's crammed in this tiny office. I had in addition to writing about, you know, iPhone rumors and iPad rumors and, you know, the new whatever phones, I was signing for packages. And when someone would come in for an interview or a meeting or something, I would have to be the de facto receptionist. And now we have that all, you know, we have a reception desk in our new office, and it's a big office with 2 floors, and it's just amazing. And it's actually across the street from that first office I worked in. So it's just amazing to see things change so quickly and just to be a part of that ride.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to take one step back, because we've had a couple of journalists who have come on the very shows that I've hosted here on Twit. And it's always fascinating to hear their stories, because there's always a little bit of a common thread, no matter what their beat may be, no matter what their passion is. It was, I knew I wanted to be a journalist. I knew I wanted to write. I knew I wanted to create content even before I knew what I wanted to create it about. It sounds like you got the tech bug pretty early on, but what was that first thing that really pushed you to journalism? I know you said that you were really good with English. You loved writing. You loved turning a phrase. But did you find that before tech or about the same time?
I found it before tech. I mean, I was definitely reading and writing before I got into technology. I mean, I think I didn't get into technology, get into that first computer when I was 5 years old. By then, I was already reading and writing, and I was really into it. I think the first time I really got into it, I used to want to be an astronaut. You know, when you're 5 years old or 6 years old, every kid wants to be an astronaut or something crazy like that, a Power Ranger or something. But then in second grade, so I was six or seven, however old you are in second grade, we did like this mock class newspaper. And I wrote my first review then. You know, it's actually kind of funny. I write reviews all the time now for smartphones and other technology. And I wrote my first review. It was of Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for Sega Genesis. And that was the first article I ever wrote. And I think that's when I really got into it. I loved writing and writing about things and about people. And it started with a Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for Sega Genesis review.
You started with a Sonic the Hedgehog 2 for Sega. You wrote for who? Who'd you write that for?
It was my teacher, my second grade teacher, as like a class project. We just did like a mock class newspaper as kind of just like an English project. And everyone got to write an article or something. And I had just gotten Sonic 2. So this was, what year was that? Early 90s, whatever year, if you want to Google it, whatever year Sonic 2 came out. And I just got, and I was obsessed with the game. So I wrote a review of it, and my parents probably saved it somewhere. But I just think it's funny that my first real bit of journalism, if you want to call it that, was reviewing some sort of technology. And now I guess that's what I'm doing again.
You know, that's actually a common thread that I see through a lot of the bridging generation, you know, between Generation X and the millennial generation, where technology was just starting to be okay. I'm still that generation where I was an oddball because I was into technology, because no one knew what technology was and why you'd want to do it. But the fact that you could do certain things was always considered weird, interesting, but weird.
Yeah.
Let me guess. Were you the AV guy for your computer, for your class?
No, actually, a lot of times because we were a pretty tech savvy school, actually, by the time I was in high school, like every classroom had a computer hooked up to a TV screen so we can do like PowerPoints or something for presentations. But whenever that would like screw up, my teacher had always, I was always the one they called on. And, you know, even still to this day, when I go home and visit my parents, you know, I'm the fix it guy. But yeah, in high school, I wasn't too into, I didn't do anything like officially, you know, like it was just a hobby. I was into my school newspaper, and I was, did a lot of volunteering work, and I was in the band. I played trumpet. And that's where a lot of my like official activities were, I guess. I was never like the AV guy or, you know, the theater technician or anything like that.
And isn't it great when your hobby becomes your career?
Yeah. It doesn't feel like work.
I don't know if this is for you, but for me, every once in a while, I look around and I see all the stuff I get to play with and all the stuff I get to do. And I kind of think, they're paying me for this?
Oh, yeah.
Strange.
Yeah, I was telling the chat room earlier, I get to test all the stuff before you guys get to see it. I wish I could show you what's in my bag right now.
Oh, you have to sign NDAs, don't you?
Yeah, I don't sign them, but, you know, verbal agreement. Yeah, so.
Actually, let's talk a little bit about that, because I think that's part of the gadget review process that a lot of our chat room, and in fact, a lot of the technorati don't quite understand how it is that you get devices that haven't been released yet. You know, for example, I have a couple of PR people that I work with who represent multiple companies, and we have a relationship enough that they know they can send something to me, even though I'm not signing an NDA, and I'll honor when the release date is supposed to happen. I get it. I get to play with it. And most of the time I send it back. I know there's a group out there that think that if you're a tech reviewer, it means your closet is filled with everything you've ever reviewed in your entire life. That's not how it works.
No, not at all. Yeah. And it's also, you see on Twitter and people saying stuff like that, oh, Apple is buying you off by giving you the iPhone. No. The way it works is, well, we have a policy not to do a written NDA just for our own protection, because that's a legally binding thing. We just do, we will either agree to hold something under embargo in an email or verbally. And I have relationships with these companies, like you just said. So, you know, they trust me. They know I'm not going to break an embargo. And the way this works is, you know, they give you the device early so you can have time to play with it and stuff. But the agreement you have to make is, okay, I won't publish anything about it or tweet about it or take any photos or, you know, whatever about it until an agreed time. And so that's why you often see, all the iPhone 6 reviews, you know, the first round came out the same time on the same day. It's because all those writers, they agreed to Apple and said, okay, I agree not to write about or publish my review of the new iPhone until 9 p.m. on Tuesday. And that's how these things work. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad overall. I don't think it applies, in a world where so much journalism is done online. The embargo is really a holdover from the print era, back when, and a midnight embargo meant nothing, because most people aren't going to read the newspaper until, 8 a.m. or 7 a.m. the next day. But today, embargoes have this different meaning online and different time zones. You'll see Samsung, which is a Korea company, often has really weird embargoes. I think their embargo for the Galaxy S5 was midnight Eastern. It's kind of this weird holdover that I wish the PR industry would sometimes start rethinking. And then there are embargoes for other bits of news too, that, sometimes we just decline the story because it's not interesting enough, but we only do it if it's like something worth that we think our readers would be interested in. But yeah, it's very common. That's how the system works, I guess. It has its benefits and its drawbacks.
I've occasionally received gear with weird, weird embargo times, like 5:23 a.m. And I'm thinking,
oh, I've never gotten that.
Who comes up with this? What's the significance of 5:23? And I asked about it, and they're like, well, we're having a press conference and we're thinking it's going to take 23 minutes for them to actually. I'm like, that is the stupidest thing ever. How about at the start of the press conference? Can we do that?
Yeah. Sometimes you do start a press conference. I think some companies have started doing, like, they just give themselves enough buffer, like if the press conference starts late or something, they'll do like 45 minutes in or something like that. And you can always tell. It's no, you know, if you follow enough tech journalists and tech publications on Twitter or something, you can tell when the embargo lists, because they all just blast out the same review at once or something, or the same bit of news at once. And again, you know, there's a benefit to that. It helps me because I get to spend more time with the device, and it helps my readers because they want to know what I think about it, and they want to know if it's worth buying. So they need to know that before the thing goes on sale. So there is a benefit there.
Steve, okay, let's get into something, because this is your livelihood. Your word is the only credibility that you have. It's the only real currency you have. And one of the things that happens a lot to people like you who has to look at gadgets that are coming out from the big players, who has to do those early reviews, is obviously the fanboyism. There's always people who are saying, oh, he's an Apple shill, he's a Microsoft shill, he's a Samsung shill, or, you know, he's a fanboy, he's getting paid. You've heard it all. And I think most of the time we kind of shrug that off. It's like, okay, I get it. But I think the insidious stuff is when people start saying things like, oh, well, the reason why so-and-so gets early review units is because he always does positive reviews, and he would never do a negative review because that means that X company would never send him something else. Do you run into that a lot? Do you hear that in your, especially in your Twitter channel?
Yeah, I do. And comments and emails. And, you know, the thing I would point out, it's like, oh, you know, if someone said that to me about a Samsung phone or something, like, you know, I'm pretty hard on Samsung. I don't think their products are well-designed. I think they're plasticky. And you can look at the body of my work. There's, what is that? That's the Gear Fit that you're showing. I said it's a sleek smartwatch, but man, overall that review is pretty negative. Samsung continues to work with me. They continue to give me products early. They respect my opinion. They've asked me for my opinion before products even launch. Hey, what do you think of this thing? We're about to launch it. And other companies have done that too. So, you know, I think if a reader is intelligent, he or she will look at the body of your work and see where you stand and see that you're fair. That's like you said, your word is all that matters, and your word and every word I've written is out there and out there on the web. You can see what I think about everything already. You know my philosophy on these things, and I don't think that's going to change. You know, it's not about being an Apple fanboy or a Samsung fanboy. There are things I think Samsung does way better than Apple. I think Apple, for example, was way too late to the phablet trend. They did it well. I think this is an amazing device, the 6 Plus. But you know, I think they should have honestly done it 2 years ago. That, you know, increasing the iPhone 4 to the iPhone 5 just a half an inch was not enough. And clearly there's a thirst for these big devices, and Apple was late to it. I think Samsung really proved to the world that there's a market for these giant phones. And I've always been open and honest about that. And when the first, another example, when the first Galaxy Note came out, I trashed it because I thought it was huge. I thought it was absurdly comically large. 2 years later, I gave the Galaxy Note 3 a great review. This was last year. And I started the review out was like, I'll admit it, I was wrong. Like, I missed the phablet trend, and I totally owned up to it. And I think that's important in a reviewer too. That gains trust in the readers, that you can also admit when you're wrong about something.
Right. Steve, your microphone's rattling a little bit on one of your buttons. Oh. So you just move it a tiny bit.
There you go.
But I want to stay on that, because even in the chat room, we've got people like Creamy Corn Cob and Almost Networking who, you know, rightfully so, they get that little wry smile saying, oh, well, you know, yeah, of course they respect your honesty, and that's what they would expect out of you. You're a journalist. But isn't it easier sometimes to get gear if a company knows you're going to give them a positive review? And I think that's what a lot of the audience thinks. They think, well, maybe he's not consciously deciding that he's going to gloss over all the faults of a product or promote another product. But, I mean, if I was a PR person, I'd want to give the gear to the person who I know I'm going to get a positive review out of. And if you can't do that to me, I'm going to pass you by for the first round of the next product. Does that actually happen?
I've never had that happen. Maybe it happens with some other companies, but the big guys, the Googles, the Microsofts, the Apples, the Samsungs, the HTCs, you know, name a big company, I don't know. They're professional, and they have professional PR folks running their operation, and they would never, right. In my experience, maybe that's happened before. You know, I've heard stories about Apple being tough and choosing like who they give first rounds of reviews to. You know, I'll be honest, like as much as I get called an Apple fanboy, to this year was the first year they let me review one of their devices. Until, you know, I've been at the shop nearly 4 years. And until this release cycle, I used to have to go to the Apple store, buy the iPhone and review it, and then return it. Wow. And that's, you know, that's crazy. And I would always give it the best review. I've consistently every year called the iPhone the best phone, nothing but positive reviews. And Apple consistently would just block me out of the review cycle until this year. And, you know, part of that was I've worked my butt off and I've tried to build credibility for myself, not trying to lick Apple's toes or anything. But, you know, I think they saw that I have a honest opinion about these things, and I have a big following now. Business Insider has grown, and that's an audience they realize that they need to be reaching. It took some convincing.
Yeah. Here, Leo Laporte, his policy is he doesn't like review units for the gear that he's going to review. He wants to buy it.
Really?
Yeah. His thing is, look, if I'm spending my own cash, I'm going to give you my honest opinion. I don't have to please anybody. If I don't like it, I'm going to say I don't like it. If I like it, you're going to trust that I like it, because I just plunked down $600, $800, $900 for the newest phone or the newest tablet. And I think that works out well for him. But for someone like you, who has to review, literally
everything,
dozens of products a week, I don't think you
could
do that.
Yeah, a year.
Yeah.
No, I can't. I would go bankrupt. You know, I would do it for the iPhone. I'd buy the new iPhone on day one or have it pre-ordered and then just send it back and get a full refund. But no, and I return everything I review. You know, as soon as I'm finished reviewing it, I get a FedEx label or whatever from the company and ship it back. And I sign loan agreements saying that, you know, all the companies usually make you sign a loan agreement. If they don't, I send it back anyway, saying I'll return it in, I don't know, X weeks or X months. And some, even when they send you the product to review, they send you the shipping label with it. So when you're done, you can send it back right away.
Right.
Yeah. So if I kept everything I reviewed, I wouldn't have room in my apartment.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. And actually, the funny part is, like you, when I get review product, normally there's a shipping label in there. Sometimes there's not. And when I contact the company, a lot of times they'll just say, oh, we don't really want it back.
But I've had that happen. And then I donate it to Goodwill.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
I'm always associated with churches, and a lot of the gear I've reviewed has been networking gear, so I can always give away gear.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
But the interesting thing for me when I was still doing my gadget review show was the type of gear that they would ask back for. So if it was like a $40 whatever audio, blah, 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 almost guaranteed they're going to want it back. They'll give you a shipping label in the box and you send it back. The gear that the companies have not wanted back has always been like the $10,000 appliance. And I never really understood that. The last one was from Science Logic. They had me review a $150,000 network security / management box. And when I was done with the review, I'm in DC. I could have dropped it off.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, just donate to a church.
Oh, my God.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Wow.
It wasn't even a good review. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Maybe they just can't resell that or refurbish it or something.
Yeah. For them, I think it's just they couldn't use it anymore. They couldn't sell it.
Because I mostly review, I mean, the bulk of our review are smartphones and tablets, and those are really easy to refurbish and resell. So when these companies do these reviews and send them out to reviewers, they're not losing much money because they just resell the gadget at $100 off or something.
And also, there's a lot of these companies, the larger ones, that will use PR agencies that receive an allotment of review unit.
Right.
And then they just cycle it around. So they've got a list of journalists. When review units come back, they make sure everything is good and they send it out again.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Let me ask you something slightly different. And I think our chat room has always been hinting at this whenever it comes to gadget reviews. What's your process? So when you sit down with something new, and for a second, let's put aside the unboxing videos because I'm not a big fan of those. But
I almost never do that. Yeah.
I don't understand. But people watch.
People love it, man.
It's one of those things that I just can't understand. Like, you want to watch me open my box because it's going to be like you're opening my box? Is that what we're doing now? No, but when you sit down, you get a brand new piece of gear and you have to do a review on it. What do you try to do? Do you have to put yourself into a particular frame of mind? Do you have to like set the scene for yourself so that you can put yourself into the shoes of someone who just might be buying this out of a retail store? What do you do?
Yeah, I can be pretty finicky. I mean, the first thing is time. So for phones, I like approximately a week with it. And I use it as my main phone. I mean, I live on my phone. I'm always tweeting and checking email and doing stuff. You know, just I'm constantly staring. If I'm not at work sitting at my desk writing, I'm probably staring at my phone, to be honest. So that's easy. I usually try to ask for a model of the phone that I can pop my SIM card into and, you know, use it as my number. And then I just use it like I normally would for a week and compare it that way. For other stuff, like I'm about to test, have you heard of the August Smart Lock that launched today?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so I'm about to review that. I'm actually, when I get back to New York, back into my apartment, I'm going to install it. They sent me one to try out. And, you know, that's a totally different type of thing. That's something I feel like I have to test for maybe 2 weeks at least, because this thing is a barrier of entry into your home. You know, that's not something I feel, and, you know, you can assign keys to people on their smartphones and stuff. And that's like that's a major lifestyle change that I feel like if I'm going to do a good review of that, I'm going to have to go all in and try it for, I don't know. I mean, you know, I never tried anything like it before. I think 2 weeks would be enough to be able to give a good idea of what it's like living with this thing. And then I try to always, you talk about a mindset. I put myself in the mindset of a normal average person, not necessarily the Twitter audience who are very, you know, deep in this industry and care about the specs and stuff. I think about more like the every guy, my mother, my father, the people who are going into, you know, Best Buy and the Apple store and it looking on Amazon for this kind of stuff. What do they want? And the stuff they want is very basic. They want a good camera, good battery life. I'm talking phones again. They want to have all their apps and their, you know, their Angry Birds and their Candy Crush. I mean, think of the kind of stuff normal folks are doing on their phones. And that's those are the things I focus on the most when I'm using them. And then I'm trying to get creative, like doing more comparisons and stuff. And, you know, now that Apple has some bigger screen phones, well, what's it like living with a big screen Apple phone versus a big screen Samsung phone? I think that's kind of an interesting way to do a review.
Nice. Yeah. And I think you've hit on something very important, especially for people who live in the tech world like San Francisco, which is how do you cover for the normals?
Right.
It's so easy to get insulated in this industry and say, oh my God, everyone should be using Linux. Why aren't you running a Linux distro? And then, you know, you step back, you're like, oh yeah, because normals would totally not get it.
Right.
And it's funny because you get to see people get so defensive. No, Linux is so easy. You just choose this distro. And then it's like, I get it. I get your passion. I understand why it's better. Now, explain to me how I'm going to give that to my grandmother. Explain how I'm going to give that to someone who knows nothing about and cares nothing about the specs or how it works. They just want to turn it on and get Angry Birds, as you said.
And that's why I think the iPhone is best. You look at Android. Android's a great operating system. I love Android. But it's way too noisy and complex for most people. I'll give you an example. This weekend, sometimes the iPhone is too noisy and complex for people. This weekend, I was hanging out with my family for my dad's birthday. My aunt was there. She's 62 or 63 years old. And out of the blue, she goes, "Steven, what's iCloud?" You know, she had no clue. She had heard of it. She had heard of maybe the hacking thing. But, you know, you got to think, like, us geeks, we're a very small subset of the population. Not everyone reads every tech blog and watches Twit every night and pays attention to stuff with such detail that we do. So I think my job as a journalist and a writer and communicator who writes about this industry is to really distill it down and make it accessible to people. And because that audience is much bigger. I have a giant ego. I want the biggest audience possible. And the audience of the normals is much bigger than the audience of the geeks. I'll take the geeks. I love the geeks. I am a geek. But I really feel like technology is touching so many parts of our lives now that it needs to be distilled down so normal people can understand it. There's a reason why the two top tech reviewers in the world, David Pogue and Bob Mossberg, are as big as they are. It's because they write for the normals.
Right, right. And it's easy to look at that and say, oh, they're just fanboys. They just cover Apple because they get early release of blah, 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 blah product. But you're right. If you look at their writing, I can send a Mossberg article to anyone in my family, even if they have no training, they have no idea what technology does, and they'll be able to understand it. Some of the stuff that I write about some of these reviews of networking products, I send it to them, and it's Greek to them.
Right. But you're not writing for them. They're not buying that kind of stuff.
Right, exactly. I will say this. My parents, my brother, he's gone to the iSide. And he tried to get them iPads and iPhones. And both of them, after getting those, came to me and they're like, can you get us an Android device because we can't figure out these iPhones? So that's more my parents. I love my parents. It kind of reminds me a little bit. And you know this because you built your own PCs. Back in the 80s, this was the same argument, which is, well, my PC has this and this and I can add this and I can have all these specs. And the other person would say, I got a Mac because it can do this. I don't care about what's in it.
It's just right there on the box.
And is that the thing? Is that Apple's secret sauce that you see, which is it's all about the normals?
Yeah, I see it. Yes, it is. It's very easy to use and switch on and figure out how to download your favorite apps and games. I mean, you know, you get into the wonkier settings and how to back up to iCloud and things like that. I think Apple could do a much better job at explaining those wonky topics. Android phones, especially, you know, not the Nexus devices, which are the clean Android devices. Those are fine or mostly fine. But you get into the Samsung and the HTCs and even the Motorola's to a degree, and they're bogged down with junk. You know, you sign in and you have to, you know, sign in for AT&T Navigator, and you got this anti-malware software, and you got this and that. And again, geeks like you and me, we can power through that. But that's very confusing to the average person. You got to think of how the average person views this stuff.
Yeah. Let's talk about something that it's kind of touchy. I know a lot of people are going to take offense to this, but they're talking about it. Creamy Corn Cob, Caffeine Free Dave, everyone in the chat room is talking about it right now, which is I'm going to call it the blogger mentality, but I'm talking about a specific subset of the blogger population. Mm-hmm. There is, and both of us, I'm assuming that you've seen this because several of my blogging cohorts have fallen into this trap. There are groups of us who will do anything for a free device. And sometimes it means writing an article, a review that is basically a regurgitation of the press notes that you get with the product. And I think that damages us. That damages us as a whole because we get it, you know, you have bloggers and then you have bloggers. And there are those who are willing to sacrifice it all, who don't really have a reputation, so they don't feel like they're giving away a lot by saying, okay, I like it, even though I really don't, because I like it and it's shiny. How do you rise above that? I mean, obviously for you, it's by becoming part of BI, because that's a respected organization. Sure. But if you're a blogger out there trying to make a name, how do you not get grouped in with those people who are willing to do anything for a freebie?
Yeah, what's really interesting to me is when I review a device and I see someone else review the same thing and I see some of the same language that's in like the reviewer guides.
Yeah.
That's like, whoa. And you see it, you actually see it with Apple reviews a lot. That's kind of annoying. You know, 9 times out of 10 these days, I don't look at the reviewer's guide unless I need to look up like a specific spec or like, you know.
You don't look in the reviewer's like guide that. Unless you get stuck on something. Because it's like, if I need a reviewer's guide to figure out your gadget, there's something wrong with your gadget.
Right. And I usually look it up. It's like, oh, I forget like how many inches the screen is or how big the battery is. You know, it's something just like very technical, usually just or how thick it is or, you know, something like that. And even then you can just look it up online. It's online anyway. That's the only – so part of the – things I do is I just basically ignore the reviewer's guide. And these companies are also really good at walking you through the device and answering your questions before you even start the review. So, you know, they often sit you down and one-on-one, and sometimes it's with like an engineer or product person who helped build the device, which is awesome how often you get to talk to the person who helped build the thing. And you can just like pepper them with questions and concerns, and then also talk to them throughout. It's like, hey, this isn't working or whatever. But yeah, I guess my advice is if you're honest with your opinions and consistent with your opinions and fair, you don't need to worry about appeasing these companies. That's how you build an audience, is thinking of the readers first, not the companies you're covering. I don't care if Apple or Samsung go out of business tomorrow. You know, I'm just going to write what I think faithfully and honestly so my readers are informed.
And I think that's, again, going back to that whole your word is your only real asset. If you sacrifice that early on, you can't rebuild it. Credibility is almost impossible to get back once you've lost it.
And you look at journalists, plagiarism is just, you know, plagiarize once and you're dead. I mean, I don't know why people do it or even risk it. So, that's just killing your word.
I work, one of my co-hosts, Brian Chi, works at the University of Hawaii, and one of his jobs, he doesn't like doing this, but he's very good at it, is going through research that some of the professors are doing at the university whenever they think something squidgy might be happening with the data. And he shakes his head when he's telling me some of these things. Like, he's going through data and he's finding data sets that are just copied and pasted over and over and over again. And he's like, you know, A, why would you do that? I mean, you just threw your 30-year career down the drain. And B, did you really think you were going to get away with that? I mean, like someone writing a review out of the reviewer's guide, if you Google for it, you're going to find 30 copies that use the same wording. Don't you think someone's going to figure that out?
Yeah, it's just too, especially with Google, it's just too easy to get caught now. I mean, maybe way back in the print days, it was harder. I don't know. I wasn't there. But, it takes 2 seconds. Copy and paste someone's review into Google and boom, you can find out if it, or anything, you can find out if it was lifted from somewhere or even partially lifted. I mean, it happened even recently, that guy at BuzzFeed, he got fired for it.
Right. There are consequences. Now, right now, I was going to go ahead and drop into a video for a product that I had just reviewed, a little Swan quadcopter that I've been having a lot of fun with. I'm going to save that because I'm having a great time talking about
this.
Sir.
I am too, man.
Can we go into some more recent news? Because I think there's a few stories that you might be able to give us a more interesting bend on.
Yeah, sure.
The first one is just released today, this whole Dropbox hack. Now, there's been a lot of hoopla about this, about it, what it means, about whether or not Dropbox was actually hacked, whether or not those passwords and usernames were actually active. There's been a lot of follow-up. So we kind of know that it wasn't really Dropbox that was hacked. It was some third-party apps that didn't protect their usernames and passwords. What's your take on this story? Because we also heard this from Snapchat a couple of days ago where it was a third-party app that got compromised, but it still affects Snapchat. It still affects Dropbox. What's your take?
Yeah, and this is what's been annoying me between Apple's iCloud thing last month, Snapchat and Dropbox last night. You know, they pushed the blame. Oh, and they're right. They aren't lying. Their servers were not hacked or infiltrated. But it's very clear they're not doing enough to protect these alternative methods of people trying to guess and check your password. And I'll tell you this Dropbox thing broke, like 9 or 10 last night Pacific time. Mm-hmm. And I see it happen. It's like, oh, geez. So I get on the phone. I'm talking to Dropbox. And, you know, the scary thing is they're telling me, you know, we have these alerts, you know, when the rate limits, when we see, you know, Steve Kovac's account getting hit over and over and over again with the wrong password, we're able to block that and basically erase that guy's password. They call it like resetting your password or something. Right. And they said, well, we were able to do that for all the ones that leaked, the 400 that leaked. And I said, great. So there are nearly 7 million others out there. Did you block those? And, oh, we can't talk about that. We don't know. So the scary thing about this Dropbox leak is we don't know if there are nearly 7 million other passwords out there that haven't been leaked yet. And these guys are demanding Bitcoin and they probably won't get it because they're idiots. Yeah. But, you know, if they do decide to leak it, there's no way to know that Dropbox hasn't already disabled those accounts, those 7 million accounts. So that's the real scary thing. You know, these aren't, you say apps probably third-party apps in Dropbox's case probably isn't the right thing. What they think is happening is insecure websites. A lot of people use like the same passwords and log in for different things, and they're able to glean that and then guess and check it against Dropbox. Now, how they're able to say, oh, Steve's Amazon password is the same as Dropbox, and how they're able to associate that, that's what's scary, and that's what we don't know. And that's what no one's telling us, and it's scary if Dropbox doesn't know. Right. So I think what we're seeing now is, and it's going to happen again, you know, pick a major service, it's going to happen again, because we use the same logins for everything. You know, we see them shifting the blame. Maybe their servers are protected, but not these third party. And the Snapchat case is especially scary because these people, anyone who can write for Android, they're essentially able to reverse engineer Snapchat. And so you may be using Snapchat, but the person you're sending photos to might be using, what's it called, Snapseed or Feed or something,
exactly.
Whatever it's called. They might be using that without you knowing it, and they're able to store your photo, and then that gets hacked.
We talked about this yesterday on This Week in Enterprise Tech, and one of the things that we concluded was the whole thing about ephemeral messaging is you have to trust the person receiving the ephemeral message that they're not going to mess with the system. And if you can't, then you have to assume that it's not ephemeral, that it is going to hang around forever. So in essence, it means that if you're going to follow the trust no one model on the internet, which we're supposed to trust, you shouldn't even be using ephemeral messaging. It just gives you a false sense of security.
But you look at Snapchat's user base, they're all teenagers. Do you think teenagers are thinking like that? Of course not. Right. And so it's, the responsibility lies on Snapchat to protect these users, and they're not doing it. They're simply, again, they came out with a statement today, that tried to wipe themselves clean, but they're not. They're simply not doing enough, and neither is Dropbox. Apple wasn't doing enough, and it's going to happen to the next guy. The next guy is going to say the same thing. Oh, our servers weren't hacked. It was a third party, so on and so forth. Well, we need to figure out a better way, and this two-factor authentication does help to a degree, and everyone should enable it, but most people don't. And it's a big barrier to logging in. It's annoying. It's annoying to set up. It's annoying to come up with these alternative passwords. Again, it doesn't pass the mom test.
Yeah.
You know, how are you going to get your mom to sign up two-factor authentication on Gmail?
I think most of us are getting used to this idea of not having the same username and password, even though a lot of us still do. And a lot of us are getting used to using two-factor authentication. But I'm with you. I think there's something deeper here. in all these cases, in iCloud, in Dropbox, in Snapchat, these companies have rightfully said it was a third party. It was someone else. Something else happened. It wasn't our system that broke. But in the end game, it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, it doesn't matter that the reason why Snapchat became non-ephemeral was because the receiving party didn't follow the rules. It doesn't matter that Dropbox became insecure because people don't change their passwords. It's only the service. People only see the service. And this idea of being able to blame a third party, I don't think it flies with, as you would say, the normals. The normals look at it and say, what are you talking about? I gave you my username and my password and people got it. So it's your fault.
Right. It's a scapegoat for them. You know, they're not lying again. You know, they're being honest that they weren't hacked, but they're not being honest with users and they're not educating users enough about these third-party services and about how the people use passwords and about how two-factor authentication works and so on. And, you know, because you think about Snapchat and what it is, it's all about ephemeral messaging. And if they say, well, actually, it's not really about that because it's pretty darn easy for someone to create an app that just sucks in your photos and then that app gets hacked, then Snapchat blows up and it's no longer a giant social network.
Right. Steve, I want to thank you so very much for being on Padre's Corner. Believe it or not, we're actually at the end of our hour. It was an absolute pleasure. I remember the very first time I had a chat with you, it was on TN2. And I had no idea that I would be interviewing you. But when your name came up on the doc, I was like, oh, I've read this guy's stuff. This is incredible. This is so much fun. Could you please tell the audience here at Twit where they can find you? I mean, of course, they're going to want to go to Business Insider. Of course, they're going to want to go to your Twitter account. But where else can they find Steve Kovac on the
in the real world? Well, right now I'm living in San Francisco temporarily, helping out BI's West Coast office. But I'll be back in New York for good at the end of the month. You know, I don't know. The best place, if you want to follow what I'm doing, Twitter really is the best. So at Steve Kovac, just my name. And then, of course, Business Insider's tech section. And you can read everything I write there, which is businessinsider.com/tech. That's really the best way to get inside my brain, especially Twitter. I tweet a lot. I engage with my readers a lot. So if you had something cool and interesting to say, you know, talk to me. I'm always looking.
Fantastic. And of course, I believe you've got a couple of appearances coming up here on the Twit TV network. Yeah. This was totally a coincidence. I didn't know that you had other shows you were going to be on this week. You're coming up on Twit, aren't you?
I think I'm on Sunday, aren't I?
Yeah,
I am. So I'll be on Sunday, the Sunday show, which I'm really pumped for. And this is another thing going, if you want to go back to when I started, I used to watch Leo all the time on Tech TV back in the day. So it's kind of funny to like be on a show with him. So I'm looking forward to that. You guys are around Sunday. I'll be there. I'm going to drive up to the studio too. So yeah, looking forward to being there in person.
I know exactly how you feel. It is kind of weird sometimes that my desk is right next to Leo's and I see him come out in and out. I watched him when he was on Tech TV. So it's kind of like, whoa, what am I doing here? This is weird.
Yeah. I learned about the iPod on Tech TV from Leo Laporte in 2001 or whatever it was.
Oh, and don't forget, people, you got to find him on his Twitter account. Anyone who has the Death Star, the incomplete yet fully functional Death Star as their Twitter wallpaper, you know you have to follow. That's twitter.com/Steve Kovac, StevKovach. Follow him now because you'll never get him again.
I'll be around.
He'll be around. Steve, thank you again for being on the show. I really do appreciate it. And especially since you had to handle the schedule jumble when we were doing some weird stuff. We're definitely going to have you back on when we do a journalist panel. Can we count on you to come back?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Count me in.
Yeah. Steve, you have a great night and you take care.
You too. Thanks, Rod.
Now, folks, I'm afraid this is the end of this episode of Padres Corner. I hope you've had as much fun as I have. This is what the show is about, just geeking out, talking about the stuff that matters to us. Like, for example, we had people in the chat room who wanted me to ask Steve whether or not he took those old 5 1/4 inch floppy disks and used a hole punch to get 360K instead of 180K. I'm sure he did, because he was a true geek building his own boxes. Just like you and me. This is the kind of content we want to put on the air. This is what Padres Corner will be all about. And if you want to see more, why not drop by our show page? You're going to be able to find it at twit.tv/Padre. Not only will you find all of our episodes, which we're up to number 10 now, woohoo, and a bunch of beta episodes as well, but you can also subscribe if you want to get every episode of Padre's Quarter automatically on your iPhone or your tablet, your Android device, your Mac, your PC, whatever it is, we're going to give you a way to get it. Also, as long as you're going to subscribe to the feed, why not subscribe to my Twitter page? If you follow me at twitter.com/PadreSJ, that's at PadreSJ, you'll find out what I'm doing in between shows and what we're going to be covering on all the different shows I have here on Twit TV. Speaking of the shows on Twit TV, you can find me every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time for This Week in Enterprise Tech. We talk about networking, we talk about data centers, about all that big iron that I get to play with. That's Mondays. I join a couple of co-hosts just to geek out over the stuff that makes us a connected world. On Tuesdays, you're going to find me here 7:30 p.m. at night for Padre's Corner. On Thursdays, you find me twice. Once at 11 a.m. for Know How with Brian Burnett, Cranky Hippo, where we're going to go through a couple of projects that we've been working on in the DIY makerspace. And then at 1:30 for Coding 101. If you're a code monkey, if you want to be a code monkey, or if you want to get into the programming culture, Coding 101 is the place to be. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester saying thank you to all of you. Thank you to everyone here at the Brick House who makes this show possible. This has been Padre's Corner. Geek out.